Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, everybody knows the news. You all know what's going on with the election or what's not going on. It's a very strange thing. And it's also got a lot of people stressed out and a lot of people nervous and a lot of people upset and a lot of people angry. And so in response to that, I wrote an essay, which you can read at LukeNagy.com, LukeNagy.com. You can read this. And I'm going to read my essay for you because I think that this is, you know, pastorally what I wanted to say to my church and also what I want to say to you, my five or six listeners. I think I may have lost one. It may be down to five now. But I wanted to share this with you, these thoughts, as we approach a new presidency and a new, possibly an entirely new America. But anyways, the essay is entitled A Theology of Hope, which, again, you can find at my blog, LukeNagy.com. Introduction. Hope in the world. Don't hope in the world. Hope is one of the most important and most often neglected aspects of Christian theology. We talk about hope, and we think about hope, and we use the word probably multiple times a day, every day. Hope, as an idea and as a word, is probably one of the most common theological terms used in routine speech. While love is probably the most used, hope comes in a strong second. And yet I don't think that Christians, broadly speaking, know what hope is in a theological sense. Sure, we know what it means as a routine noun, but as a theological expression of the biblical concept, that's a different story altogether, because the reality is that theological hope and routine hope are not in any way, shape, manner, or form the same thing. Just as not as the world gives Jesus peace, in the same way not as the world gives Jesus hope. The hope that comes from Jesus is not different in quantity, but in quality. He has an altogether different kind of hope. But unfortunately, this word is so laden with cultural meaning, it's hard to get at what the Bible means when God speaks of hope. If we want to move forwards in understanding my thesis that there's a difference of monumental importance between hoping in the world and hoping in the world, we're going to need to understand hope. Put simply, Christian hope is the confident expectation of some future good. It doesn't mean desire, although desire and hope have a large Venn diagram overlap. Yes, we desire the things we hope for, but not all desires are hopes. Some things we desire but have no confident expectation that the thing we desire will ever come to pass. I've preached on this at length, so I don't want to spend much time defending my assertion. So instead of trying to defend this with word studies and exegetical arguments, I want to simply show that philosophically, hope can't be desire or pie-in-the-sky wishing. It has to involve a confident expectation. Corinthians 13 tells us that hope is one of the three that abide in the believer, along with faith and love. If hope could be in something deceptive, something that will never happen, then it's a deceitful hope. It's a lie. And since hope comes from God, then hope can't be a lie because it's impossible for God to lie. Now, you might say, well, okay, but maybe as humans, we're putting our hope in the wrong object, just as we can put our faith and our love in the wrong object. And of course, I would agree. And then thank you for proving my point. Hope that won't come true isn't godly hope, because God wouldn't give us a reason to confidently expect something that will never happen. Hoping for something that will never happen is worldly hope. Worldly hope is just a desire. Godly hope is confident expectation. So, with our understanding of hope, let's try to unpack what I mean when I say that there's an eternal difference between hoping in the world and hoping in the world. The argument. Recently, my wife and I went on vacation to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We loved it. I, being a Mennonite, found it fascinating to see Mennonite culture celebrated. I found it saddening to see it commercialized in a kitschy way, but more than that, I was reminded of the subtle but powerful pull that that lifestyle has for a lot of people. I could easily see myself running away to live on a sustenance farm, away from people. I could see myself living in a commune like the Hutterites or a monastic community. I could very easily go and isolate myself. I could very easily and very happily move my stuff to the middle of some vast forest and live in my library reading and writing and never having to see or deal with anyone in the world again. I could move far enough away that elections wouldn't matter, socialism wouldn't matter, taxes wouldn't matter, riots wouldn't matter. Sitting in the silent peace of my mountain library, I would just exist as a happy hermit. Or at least that's my dream. So why don't I do it? Three reasons, at least three reasons. One, God commands me not to. Two, it's exceedingly selfish and sinful. Three, it really wouldn't bring me satisfaction. And this is important for us to understand. We can't just run away from the world. We have to engage with it. We live in it, for goodness sakes. We have to deal with it. Christians need to engage with the culture and with politics, if for no other reason than because we need an entree to show people Jesus. Obviously, there are other and some better reasons to engage, but at a baseline level, we can't just live in isolation because then we won't have a witness. Or, you know, we won't be able to rightly testify to Christ by word and deed. We're to be in the world, but not of it. This is crucial, so let's think about this. If this is a command, which I take it to be, then it is a sin to be in the world and of it. People who do that are worldlings, aka unbelievers. There are also those who are not in the world, but not of it. Those would be true believers in isolation, hermits. And then there are those who are not in the world and are of it. Those would be false believers living in isolation. And those are sinning the worst. Shockingly, in some ways, it might be worse for your soul to live in a, you know, isolation or a Christian commune as a pseudo-Christian than to live a life of open and gross immorality. The worldling who is in the world at least isn't a hypocrite, but the monk who denies the master is. I see the appeal of running away. I really do. But in the end, it's disobedient, cowardly, and purposeless. It will also make you a Pharisee, twice a son of hell. But what does this have to do with hope? Well, the reason I bring this up is because all sincere Christians struggle, and I mean struggle, to walk that line of being in the world and not of it. We recognize that God has commanded us to live, work, play, eat, drink, and be merry in this world with worldlings, and try to testify to Christ. We recognize that we need to live our lives among sinners in a sinful culture with sinful values and also not become like them, but help them to be transformed into the image of Christ. What does this mean practically? This is a hard question, and unfortunately for those who like black and white, largely a matter of individual conscience. But what should become obvious is that we, as citizens of heaven, still have responsibilities here on earth. We recognize that while our mission is to make disciple-making disciples, part of that means striving to spread God's shalom even in the lost and dying world. We seek to identify the world, even though we know it's a failing task. Why? Because we are stewards, and the stewardship we've been given includes this lost and dying world. Because we're stewards of our life, liberty, time, talent, treasure, sexuality, intellect, emotions, wills, influence, friendships, churches, communities, and everything else, that everything else encompasses our earthly citizenship. If everything about me is a sacred gift from God that I am to steward, then so is my American citizenship. Since my American citizenship is a sacred stewardship, then I have a stake in politics. I have a responsibility to God about whether and how I vote. I have a responsibility in how I shape this republic. And I believe that the American republic, for all its flaws and evils, is still the best place on God's earth today, if for no other reason than that it's the best house on a bad street. America has had, and always will have problems, and serious ones. But that doesn't mean that it cannot be improved. And it certainly doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive to improve it. My personal hero, William Wilberforce, saw very clearly the problems with 18th century England. In fact, probably no one saw more clearly than he. He was aware, yet he worked to make England like Eden. In the same way, I want America to be a nation that loves and serves God, not with lip service, but in truth. I want a nation of righteous laws, ruled by righteous people. I think that this is an objective good. It is objectively good to have godly laws governing the godly. And I believe that America can be revived. I believe she can turn to Christ. I believe the ship can be saved, and we can reform, and we can right things. And that if we turn to Christ and stop sinning and then do good, then America's best days might be ahead. I'm hoping in the world. But that doesn't seem to be the trend. America seems to be dead set and determined to murder babies, outlaw Christ, and play the socialist game. We're falling towards secular paganism, aka wokeism, and it looks ugly. The academy is godless and going woke, and this includes the public school system at all levels. Culture is godless, and more young people are godless. I'm not hoping in the world. You see, on the one hand, I have the confident expectation that if we repent and turn to Christ, he will save our nation. But I'm not hoping that worldlings will suddenly do godly things without becoming godly. My hope isn't in this world. The other night's election can be interpreted in a whole host of ways if you're a Christian. And although we don't know the results yet, one thing stands out very clearly to me. God gives nations leaders they deserve, and sometimes even better leaders than they deserve. But on the whole, a godless, feckless, murderous, adulterous, greedy, and corrupt nation should expect leadership that will be godless, feckless, murderous, adulterous, greedy, and corrupt. When we live in a nation that is full of sin, we should expect to be punished for that sin. And one of the most, if not the single most common ways for God to punish a nation and national sin is to allow natural consequences to play out. In other words, God lets us reap what we've sown. When we sow to the flesh, we reap corruption. And sometimes, by his grace, we get slightly less corrupt corruption than we deserve. But God is not mocked. And one of the things that is an invincible bulwark against mockery is human nature. Godless people cannot be trusted to make good political decisions. How can they be? How can a person who hates God, the author of life, the giver of all good gifts, the font of wisdom, he who knows the end from the beginning, the Almighty, if you hate and reject him, what should you expect to get? If you separate yourself from the light, why should you not expect darkness? Whatever happens after all the votes are tallied, two things are clear. First, Christians have placed far too much hope in the world. Far too many Christians' behavior demonstrates that they see America's problems as primarily political and not moral. And since they see them as political, they believe that abortion, cultural disintegration, and socialism are political phenomena. They are not. They are theological phenomena with political ramifications. Theology is the essence and politics are the accidents. We fail to see the theological root of our problems because we've put our hope in this world. Second, America becoming a socialist state may be the only path to revival. I've been saying for years that I do not believe there will be a revival in this nation until there is persecution. So, while Christians lament that a majority of adult humans would vote for a party of unfettered infanticide, riot apologetics, socialism, and wokeism, remember that God is in control. Remember that God works out all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Will America, reshaped in the image of Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and all their ilk, be an objectively worse place to live? Absolutely. But fertile soil is full of feces and death. Perhaps the best thing for the gospel in this country is for us to face mistreatment and persecution. Will that be objectively better for the godless, woke worldlings? No. It will only heap up their sin to the full measure. It will redound to their more complete condemnation. But for believers, it may be the crucible which purifies us. In closing, I'd like to quote the words of an anonymous poem that have come to mean much to me. As Americans anticipate our country going down the tubes, let's remember that while we can hope in this world, we must never hope in the world. We need to look to Jesus. We need to trust him that when our candidates don't win, that he's still in control. And he's doing all he does for the good of his church, to make his bride more beautiful. Is there no other way, O God, except through sorrow, pain, and loss, to stamp Christ's likeness on my soul, no other way except the cross? And then a voice stills all my soul that stilled the waves of Galilee. Canst thou not bear the furnace? If midst the flames I walk with thee, I know its weight. I drank the cup I hold for thee. Canst thou not follow where I lead? I'll give thee strength. Lean hard on me. Well, like I said, that was an excerpt from a blog, an essay that I put on my website, lukenagy.com, entitled A Theology of Hope. You can go there, lukenagy.com, lukenagy.com, and you can find it on the blog page. But I hope that this was meaningful to you, and I hope that this was a reminder that as Christians, our hope can never be in this world. If our hope is wrapped up in the world going right, we're in for some very sore and sorry disappointment. But I truly believe that as things get darker and darker and darker in America, this is the opportunity for the church and the true church to shine all the brighter, all the clearer. And this may be the time of great revival in this country. And so let's not despair, because it's a sin to despair, because it's a sin to not trust that God has things in hand. So let's have hope. even in this world, without having hope in this world. I hope and pray we will, and I hope you'll join us again next week for another exciting episode of Truth in Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to His glory.